Welcome to B2B Better, a podcast that exists to explore what modern-day B2B marketing looks like. If you work for a company with long sales cycles, has a complex value proposition, and simply pouring money into ads won't see you hit your growth goals, this is the show for you. My name's Jason Bradwell. Let's get into it. Hey, everyone. Today, we're talking to Joel Kletke, who is the founder of Case Study Buddy. It won't be any surprise to you to hear that we are talking today about case studies. Now, when I worked for a large global technology solutions provider, case studies were an elusive beast. We worked in the media broadcast sector, so a lot of our clients were broadcasters and sports teams and federations. And so getting case studies from companies like that was really hard because the response we would typically get when asking for a case study was, hey, we've got a bunch of brands paying us and sponsoring us for the rights of association. Why would we give that to you for free when we're the ones paying you? And so digging into this topic with Joel was a really interesting conversation for me because he provided some really actionable, tangible ways in which to thaw the ice, let's say, with customers who maybe are a little bit skeptical, a little bit resistant to signing on the dotted line and greenlighting that testimonial case study that you so desperately need. Give me a couple of reasons why most B2B case studies fail to hit the mark.
First and foremost, so many of them don't have any intentional strategy put behind them. There's no thought, there's no process. It's just someone's been tasked with capturing a customer success story and they go through the motions and produce something generic that ticks the boxes and off they go. It's surprising to me that we will put so much time and so much attention into other content. We plan out content calendars for months. We have topical pillars. We have, you know, different themes that we'll press into. And then when it comes to stories, it's like, well, as long as we told the story of a win, isn't that good enough? And no, it's not. So I think that's the fundamental reason. There's just not a lot of thought or strategy put to them. Another big reason is because there are so many disciplines or skilled tasks involved in doing these, you need to be a good interviewer. You need to be a strong storyteller. You need to have that strategy component. I think they're difficult to do. And they're also difficult to do because there are different perspectives, even internally, often on what will make a good story. Sometimes leadership wants something really metrics driven, even when that doesn't make sense for the space or isn't true of the relationship. Other times marketing wants to press a certain angle when sales is saying, well, actually, we really need stories in these verticals. And so you wind up with these kitchen sink stories where they try to pack every good ingredient into one story and it comes out very scattered, very unfocused. And then I think the last reason that most case studies miss the mark is because they're written from the perspective of the company. They're not customer centric. They're company success stories rather than customer success stories. And I think every great case study I've ever read or watched thrives on the experience of the customer. It thrives on not only what happened, but how that felt and why they made those decisions or why that path was taken. There's tension, there's stakes, there's relief, there's elation, there's not just, you know, what was done, but why it mattered, and not just what was achieved, but what was made possible because of what was achieved. And you only ever get that by including the customer in the story. You're never going to get that huddling around a boardroom table and bashing up the bullet points. So I think those are some of the most common reasons they whiff on them and why so many of these things are so boring and so bad.
So you mentioned there what kind of, you touched on what some of the great case studies have. Can you kind of walk me through a story of a case study that you've worked on in the last 7 years, you know, running your business that really exceeded expectations, and then try and sum up why you think that was?
Yeah, I think there's been a lot of different stories we've worked on that, you know, we were surprised by. One of them, the study itself is anonymous, which to me is interesting enough because most people think anonymous stories are boring or not that valuable. But for a major financial institution out of the States, we were doing a story with them for a cybersecurity company. And a lot of the time in this space, stories are very high level, very surface level. And from the moment the interview started, we kind of knew things would be different because this was a very emotional story. Our interviewer pressed into, you know, what had happened was there was a breach. There was a really bad situation unfolding. And as we got into the emotion of that story and what it felt like to experience that, it became almost this like late night TV piece, almost this like, not murder mystery, but kind of a little bit, you know, like what was the cause of this situation? How are we going to solve this problem? And so when the story came together in the writing, one of the things that my writer did very well is they didn't lose that. They didn't dumb it down. They didn't make it hyperbole. And now you've got this thing that feels too wild and crazy to believe. But the story starts in medias res, just plunging you right into the tension of the situation. And even though it was anonymous, because we interviewed the customer, we were still able to use their quotes and their experience to tell that story. So throughout the whole story, even though, you know, we're not attributing it to a name, we're attributing it to a title, we have these very believable, very rich quotes woven throughout this anonymous piece, where you can start from the beginning, the stress of the situation, the anxiety, the relief when things started to come to a head and started to get resolved. And then, you know, the elation again at the end of the story, where now not only, okay, have we mitigated this issue, but knowing they have the confidence that the Veronis will be able to step in again and squash similar problems and bring calm to the chaos. It really is this story that, you know, we've told over 90 stories for Veronis over the years. You think that they would get stale and boring and old with time, and the opposite seems to be happening. We seem to be getting better and better at bringing that very human element in. And I think that was the core. It's just that human element that nobody on my team stomped on or made generic or dumbed down. We let it be what it was, and what it turned into was a really compelling story to read.
You mentioned their anonymous case studies, which I find really interesting because, you know, my background was working for the last 5 years before I started up B2B Better as a business, was working for a global enterprise solutions provider in the sport sector. So we would build technology solutions for the NFL, UEFA, Olympics, MLB, et cetera, et cetera. And when it came to case studies, it was usually like pulling teeth because these organizations would have brand deals, sponsorship deals with other organizations, Olympics, Coke, for example. And why would they then give a vendor that they're paying the right to talk about, you know, the work that they've done? You know, they didn't typically have a problem with, you know, the case study in of itself. They just didn't want to be name checked in it because they could put that kind of corporate brand relationship at risk. So we used to do a lot of anonymous case studies and they usually perform pretty well, but I know that they sometimes leave a bit of a bad taste in certain marketers' mouths. So just talk me through like your thoughts on anonymous case studies. Are they valuable or are they a waste of time?
Yeah, it took me a long time to come around on this. You know, you always want the logo, you know, you always want the big name. It feels so integral. It feels so critical, but over time, and in the doing of these stories, there's some things that I've realized that I was blind to previously. I think number one, sometimes anonymity is actually a gift. When a brand is named, boy, do the legal teams, the PR teams, boy, do they scrutinize you. It gets to the point that you are so hemmed in that you almost can't tell a compelling story. And then the only thing that's compelling about the story is the brand. Well, that's not great. It's wonderful to show, well, we work for this big company, but I think the power of a customer story is in its relatability. It's in the fact that there is a narrative arc to follow and an experience to dig into. And one of the things that we've seen firsthand is when a story is anonymous, it can sometimes be a gift because you can go deeper into the details than you otherwise might ever get to. You can actually share more metrics, more specifics. We could paint this realistic picture of the stress and anxiety because there was no one going, well, this can be tied back to us and we don't want to send the wrong message. So that's something we learned is you can actually use it as a gift to dig a little bit deeper. I think there are trust signals you can use in anonymized stories to show that we didn't just make all of this up. I think different things can play into that. Things like leveraging very specific customer quotes. Yes, we could make these things up, but there's something to be said for these ultra specific, ultra detailed quotes attributed to a consistent person through the story that adds that layer of credibility and really adds depth to the story. And that wasn't always something we did. In the beginning, we were very reticent to include quotes, and then realized, well, hey, if we can attribute this differently, there's actually low to no risk, and it added a lot of depth to the story. But I think another thing that I realized in time and came to accept is in certain verticals, anonymity is the expectation, and to not have anonymity can actually be more unusual. So you look again at a space like cybersecurity or healthcare or some of these bigger brand plays, and they would expect, we want our name protected, we want our NDA, you know, adhered to. And so when you've got these spaces where anonymity is the expectation, then having a line in your story saying, you know, we are happy to honor the client's request to keep this anonymous and not to explore these aspects, it can actually be a trust signal in and of itself, because prospects can see you are protecting the identity of your clients. You're not putting their reputations at risk to benefit your own. So while there is always going to be, I think, a contingent who always, you know, it's brand name or bust, I think embracing the anonymous story as its own thing and as its own powerful collateral is something that took us a while to do. But now that we do it, you know, some of our best performing stories for clients are these anonymous ones, because you tell them in a way that really lands, paints a believable picture, and in some cases, as I mentioned, goes even deeper than we could have otherwise.
I mean, what are your clients' attitudes towards anonymous case studies?
Most clients have to be won over. Most are, again, unless they understand, unless they're in a space where, again, it's the norm to anonymize, most need to be convinced. They treat it as a last a Hail Mary if a project's not going well. And again, I think that's understandable, right? We've done hundreds, if not, well, we have done thousands of stories at this point. And if it took us a few years to come around on these as the valuable assets they could be, you know, I expect the same of others. That being said, you know, I think what can also happen is where they start to open up to them more is if we can show them some examples of well-told stories, and if we can talk about the ways to preserve the power of the stories. And then if we can mention, oh, by the way, this can really help for scale in these sensitive spaces, then they tend to come around. Because like anyone, you know, marketers carry a quota sometimes when it comes to stories. We need one a quarter or however many a year. And so if it's a tool that helps them ultimately achieve what they want to achieve, and especially if we can do one really, really well and they can deploy it and gauge the impact, then they tend to come around. But I think there's a general resistance to it overall, and it does take some doing to win a client over and help people see that yes, these still can be the assets you want, the ROI you're looking for.
Case studies can sometimes feel like a bit of an afterthought. You know, we're asking the client when the project is complete. There has to be a more proactive way of approaching them. You know, one of the ways that I've tried to do it in the past is ensuring that there's like rights in the contract for case studies, but there's two things there. Like one, either they get immediately ripped out by the client as a negotiation piece, or that when it comes to time to asking for the case study, again, coming from an enterprise background, there's usually like a couple of layers between us, the marketing team, and the end client. So when we make that request into our sales team or our account management team, the response usually comes back of, oh, no, like the project didn't end as well as we wanted it to, or that it's on fire at the moment, or there's some sort of like reason why we shouldn't be doing this at this point, we're just not going to do it. So like, how do we make case studies an inevitable consequence of a client relationship?
Yeah, I think you're touching on something really close to my heart, and that's this idea. I call it proactive versus reactive storytelling. So most companies tell these customer stories, as you're describing, reactively. Someone's either been given a mandate, go get stories, or someone's miraculously put up their hand and said, we've had a win. Now you're, in any case, you're rushing to capture the story in reverse. You're trying to go back now and rediscover the context and secure approval and rediscover what brought them in and the pains and all of that. I think if you want to be proactive about these, if you want to make them inevitable, then it needs to be this team sport. I think that's the first point is, as you mentioned, case studies, customer stories, they're a team sport and they always will be. It's not marketing's pet project. And this starts with You know, having some central source of truth, some documentation, some agreed upon kind of goals and targets, not just for marketing, but for all the other teams. And the reality is all these other teams benefit from this activity. CSMs, sales, they want referrals. They want these stories. They just don't love enabling them on someone else's terms. So how do we go from reactive to proactive? I think the first thing you can do is start by, let's say you're in marketing, start by standing up a very basic SOP. And in that SOP, lay out as you know it, okay, what are our gaps that we're aware of? What are our coverage gaps, right? What stories are we missing? And talk to sales about that. Don't say we need nominations. Don't go to them through the guise of, can you do something for us? But simply have a conversation around, where are you missing stories? Where do you not have the ammunition, the anecdotes, the stories that you need? And laying that out. I think one of the things you brought up is something that infuriates marketing teams, and that's getting there. And it's like, oh, the project could have been better. It's actually on fire. Oh, it'll be better in 6 months. One of the most important things you can do as an organization is arrive at and document in the same SOP some shared criteria for recognizing a win. What, it sounds benign or banal, I should say, but what does a win actually look like? What are our win criteria? And make that objective so that sales can't veto it. Someone else can go, make it objective. I think, as you mentioned, can you put these things in your contracts? Yes. Is it usually one of the first things redlined out? Also, yes, it can be a bargaining chip. It can be something, you know, for that reason, I think it's still worth trying. But when it comes down to it, I think what it comes down to is have an SOP, document the coverage gaps, have discussions with the other teams about what kinds of stories would benefit you and also what formats would benefit you. Like if you're on a marketing team and all you're producing are these long written pieces or long videos, your sales team probably hates you because they want something succinct that they can go and take quickly, something very concise, maybe a slide to talk through. So ask them, what would you benefit from? And then have this shared criteria for a win. And if you can put it on the calendar, you can make it something that people are reminded to take part in. You can make it less of a kind of make a push and then wait 6 months and make a push. What I mean by put it on the calendar is, once you've aligned with these other teams on what they want and how you can serve them, is there an opportunity to do something like a Wins Wednesday, where one Wednesday a month, sales leaders, marketing leaders, CSMs meet, talk about what's going on in the accounts, flag potential fits for coverage gaps, discuss the status of different accounts so you can move that forward. But everything I'm talking about, put some infrastructure to it, make it shared. Other teams are more likely to participate in a process they've had a voice in shaping. So ask them what they need, how they would benefit, what collateral would make more sense. And I think that is planting the seeds. I'm not going to say it's easy. It's not going to happen overnight. You can do all of these things and it can still be a battle. But by starting to get some of your internal house in order, it makes it easier and easier, because eventually now you have a process you can bring clients into, as opposed to welcome to the chaos and ping-ponging around and all of that. So there are many things you can do, but starting with an SOP and some internal structure is one of those things that enables so many doors to open.
Have you ever seen clients either offer discounts or basically provide some sort of monetary incentive to a client in order to acquire a case study?
Yeah, it certainly happens. I think what a lot of companies are not aware of is, if you're in the practice of doing that, you need to disclose it. And it sounds like one of those none with the ruler wrapping your knuckles, but I've seen entire Google ad campaigns just nuked by Google because they pointed to case study pages that were not verified or that type of thing. So it's not rocket science. You do have to have some disclosure. I think ultimately, though, to me, having to use an incentive is a symptom of a bigger problem. If you're not making talking about performance a regular part of your relationship with the client, if you're not taking steps to make sure they are satisfied, if you're not actively building advocacy, then incentives feel like the only way forward. Well, can we bribe you? Can we give you something? Can we monetize this for you? And that's not to say that that's a universal truth, but more often than not, people want to use incentives as band-aids where there's no process or relationship. And that is where I tend to start. Yes, you can look at what would be valuable. I think, though, there's other benefits you could present. Sometimes it's positive press. It's saying, we're going to share this in this type of campaign. We're going to put you in an incredible light. You have final say on what goes into the store in terms of how you're presented in the details. And we're going to expose you to this large audience. Or sometimes it can be, you know, not normally with enterprise. They couldn't care less in most cases, but maybe it's a link back to the site. You know, maybe it's being part of a customer advisory board with incentives for being part of the board. That can be another way of coming at it versus incentivizing the individual story. So lots of ways to slice that apple. But if you're finding you repeatedly have to incentivize monetarily on a story level, I'd encourage you to zoom out a bit and think, are there other areas of the process where we're dropping the ball or we're not fostering a real connection here?
That's a great answer. I think that if you can find ways also to like appeal to the individuals within the client account, that can be a way of unlocking case study opportunities. Like we did one with the NFL, where when you spoke to the PR or legal team, you know, case studies were just totally out of the question. Almost unnecessarily so. You know, it was almost like we just blanket ban, don't do them. We're not gonna do this case study. But then when we go to the VP who has a appetite for public exposure for his own personal profile, and we're going to him instead with an opportunity of we've got this speaking slot at this big conference and we want to invite you on to kind of talk about all this great work that we've done together, but this is really about you and your organization, and we're just there to help facilitate the convo. You bet he signed up like within 2 minutes of receiving the email. So it was kind of a workaround of getting that kind of positive credibility testimonial, which we were then able to repurpose into written work because it was then in the public domain. So yeah, I think there's also something to be said around that.
Yeah. I mean, counterintuitively, and this is something that I've been made aware of more recently, especially because we were struggling. We have a client who engages with government, and similarly, it's blanket, no, can't do this. And you know, I went to the community, the customer marketing and advocacy community. I said, what do you do here? And they said, it's often easier to get a client on a stage than in a case study. And that holds true. And similarly, another thing, especially enterprise to enterprise, you pointed out, you know, we're dealing with people, and people have their own motivations, and the right people can make things happen. And so something that, you know, happens more and more often and that we encourage is, if your senior, you know, executive suite, C-suite leadership can get involved sometimes in these asks with other executive C-suite leadership, sometimes that moves the needle in ways that legal and PR teams, you know, can't swat down from the sky with their big fun-killing stick. You know, there are these personal motivations, and finding ways to tap into them, whether that's prestige, whether that's wanting to share, whether that's wanting to look competent, elevate my own personal profile, as you pointed out, those can all be means to an end as well. So that was something really interesting, you know, within the past 2 years that was pointed out to me is, yeah, you might be able to get them on a stage rather than in a case study. And we've seen that hold true as well. Like as a practical example, just a couple of weeks ago, a client in the healthcare supply chain industry was holding a summit for their clients to be there. And it is like pulling teeth to get these people to be in case studies if you approach it as a case study. But we made 30 video slots available. We filled 27 of them, recorded these people, and they could not stop. We didn't ask them to. They couldn't stop singing the praises of the company in those interviews. And we left with amazing content. And again, they got on a stage, got release and approval for that content, got a chance to share their wisdom. And in exchange now, this client leaves with a wealth of content on the social proof side. So I think that's a really wise and astute way of coming at it. And I think something a lot of companies haven't considered yet.
Just all about having tools in your arsenal, right? Like there is probably a conventional way of going out there and acquiring a case study. But if they say no, that doesn't mean that it's never, absolutely not, never talk to us again about this. It's just about them saying, okay, can we go back to the drawing board and figure out another way of getting to the end result, which is essentially you know, demonstrating some sort of credibility as an organization, you know, but through association of working with this client, and how the format in which that takes, we can be flexible with. I want to talk a little bit about the case studies themselves. You know, what often feels lacking to me is like any sense of story. You know, I think a boilerplate case study, template, problem, solution, results, but often that kind of fails to hook, at least me personally. So what can we do if we're writing case studies or producing case studies to overcome this? How can we differentiate?
I think start by realizing that any story you've ever read or watched in your life, they all have the same elements, similar to a case study. You know, they have the beginning, the middle, and the end. And that doesn't mean that all those stories you've watched or read are the same. So why should that be the same for your case studies? Yes, they're all going to have a challenge. Yes, they're all going to have a solution. And hopefully they're all going to have positive results. But you can put that through so many different lenses and so many different frames to make that compelling. One of the words I mentioned earlier, phrases that I mentioned earlier, is coverage gaps. And this is really where this shines. A coverage gap is essentially when you look at the landscape of your buyer's journey, where are you light on content? What objections aren't you able to counter as well? What competitors aren't you speaking to your differentiators as well? What industries are you trying to break into that you haven't really disambiguated, you know, why you're valuable to that industry? So by starting with conversations with your sales team or internally, where are we going? Where are we seeing challenges? What's difficult about selling today? You know, where are people falling off? That will illuminate. It'll give you a bit of a roadmap in terms of what types of stories ought we to be telling. And forget case studies for a moment. You know, what types of themes or topics should we be covering? And then from there, that can translate into some really compelling stories. So practical examples, you can have switcher stories. So especially in software, someone who was using a competitor made the decision to leave and came to you. You can have disambiguator stories. So one of my favorite examples for this is company produces kind of industrial grade air filtration systems. Typical client profile is like manufacturing and like glass dust fibers and things like that. But when the pandemic hit, a new market opened to them, gyms. People who run gyms, people who go to gyms, the benefits for gyms, they might want air filtration. They just don't understand when you talk all this gobbledygook, you're talking to manufacturing. So having some case studies showing, yes, we are this industrial provider, but yes, this is how this would look in your industry. That's compelling to that audience. You can take stories and take a very skeptical angle. Go find your biggest skeptics turned clients and talk about the journey to you and what ultimately won them over. That can be very compelling. Some of the best case studies, I can't take credit for them at all, but there's a company called Mutiny. And they do fantastic playbook style stories where it's not only a success story, but all the ingredients to replicate that success are in the story. So it's a client, but it's also a recipe of how that client deployed or used the tool. And those stories start with what you'll learn, which I love as a lead into a story because it makes a promise on my time that's valuable. What you'll need is the second bit. So how once I'm through this story and I want to replicate that success, I'm going to learn how to do it. I'm going to learn what I need. And then by the end of that story, I'm going to go, I need to use Mutiny to get this ROI. So I think zooming out again and thinking through what types of stories, what themes, what business or revenue challenges do we have and what stories could support that, I think considering all of that will give you good ideas from a thematic or topical level of what your stories can be about. And there's more we can get into on the actual telling of those stories to make it more compelling, but I think it really starts there.
You mentioned earlier about the need for kind of strong interviewing skills, you know, for the person who's creating the case study on behalf of either the client or the company. I'd love for you to dig into that a little bit more and like, you know, what can, you know, because I almost kind of look at it as like a journalist, you know, I'm a former journalist. It's where I kind of started my career, a trade journalist. And I feel like, you know, if you come from journalism, you can make a good marketer, a good storyteller. But just so I have a soundbite of like some of the attributes or some of the skills that an individual should look at, you know, acquiring themselves or developing when it comes to creating better case studies, what kind of fits into that?
Yeah. And there's a reason that, you know, we look for journalists on our interviewing team, because a lot of the traits that make a good journalist are the same as someone who makes a great case study interviewer. So I think number one is the ability to build rapport, but build rapport in a way that very quickly demonstrates to the person, this is not about me. This is about you. Your goal as an interviewer is to transform the person from an interviewee into a storyteller, to take someone who is often nervous or guarded or over-rehearsed, worried about saying the perfect things, and bring their guard down to a point that they can just talk and they can just share their experience. So the ability to build rapport very quickly and kind of diffuse this nervousness, you know, there's a lot to be said for being kind and being friendly, but being strategically. So I think another enormous skill is the actual research and framing of the question sets. You can't just walk into every interview with the same base 10 questions and hope to walk out with something deep and rich and compelling. I think the best interviewers we have are also the most invested in understanding the brief, gathering the context that's available, looking for context outside of the brief, and then using that to inform the questions that they ask. So thinking through how can, you know, I know where I'd like this story to go based on the brief I have. How can I lead someone there without them feeling yanked along? I think another big one is the ability to shut up, to let there be silence and let the person work through their response. And that's really difficult, especially when you're trying to preserve time. You know, you're dealing with lawyers or high-level executives or important people whose time is money. The ability to just pause and let them sort themselves out and let them, you know, mull over a question, that's something that is very important, not just filling time, peppering them with questions. I think that all matters a great deal. And then the real art of the interview really is in the follow-up. Your base questions are just there as springboards, but to be an active listener, to be able to take in the information and recognize, oh, based on the research I've done, based on what I know of this industry, based on what I know of the goals for this story, here's where I need to push in. And here's where I need to pull back. Here's where, you know, they've dangled a thread and I need to grab that and chase it. And so, you know, again, the best interviewers aren't necessarily the most eloquent speakers. They're often simply the best researchers and listeners. And that makes a great deal of difference when you're taking someone and trying to transform them from interviewee, interrogation style, just responding to questions, and more bringing them out of themselves in a way that is emotional and compelling and honest and real.
I want to finish up by talking a little bit about case study conversion and how we kind of measure the success of case studies. I think this is a very obvious way, which is that, you know, hey, we publish a case study and then people get in touch for a demo or a sales call or whatever it is. But kind of talk to me about how you help your clients measure the conversion of case studies and what they can do to convert them better.
Yeah, I think first we have to recognize that there is no singular way to use a customer success. And in fact, what makes these assets so unique and valuable is they can be deployed across the entire buyer's journey. You can use case studies for lead generation. You can use them in cold outreach. You can use them in nurturing. You can use them in upselling. You can use them in retention. And you can even use them internally for things like morale or training. And so, you know, while I'd love to just say, well, here are the metrics exactly, so much of how you measure the success will depend on how you deploy. But some common ways, some things to be thinking about, some concepts to take away. Number one is benchmarking. Whether you're using them in cold outreach or ads, benchmarking them against campaigns that do not use those elements. So if you've been doing cold outreach campaigns where you haven't been leveraging case studies, how do the new campaigns compare against the old ones? If you're running remarketing campaigns where you're using case studies and pushing to case study pages, how do those fare relative to previous campaigns? Because if you look at them just in isolation, it's easy to go, oh, it's really performing, or oh, it's really not. So looking at a benchmark, especially when it comes to customer stories versus other types of content, that becomes very important. I think it's dangerous to look at case studies solely through the lens of went to case study page, converted to demo. I think that's rarely the case because that's not usually where and how we use case studies in our process. We use them to inform decisions. We might take them around internally. We might link off or pass them to someone else. So some other ways of measuring the success, I think one is assisted conversions, looking at, for example, using a CRM like HubSpot, looking at, okay, in buyer's journeys, where do these turn up? How often are case studies part of that flow? How do flows that have interacted with these fare against those that they haven't? One of the more interesting ones I can't take credit for, but One of the more important areas to measure that's also very hard to measure is in sales. And so again, talking to your sales leaders and benchmarking the before. So, you know, how confident in these types of scenarios are you that a deal will close? Is it 60%, 70%? What does that look like? And then whether it's, you know, a few months out or 6 months or what have you, after you've delivered some of these resources, coming back and asking again, what does your confidence in these situations? Is it now 70%? Is it 80%? No, it's not going to be scientifically precise, but getting some benchmark of sales confidence, closing confidence, close rates, or even close timelines. So how long are, you know, deals taken to close? How long is the life cycle of a deal? Those are all really important ways to look at and measure the impact of case studies as well. So regardless of how you do it, the one way you should not do it is just look at one-to-one case study to conversion rates. You want to look at how they contribute to the larger ecosystem of marketing, sales, outreach, nurture, and so on. So lots of different ways to come at it. But those are some of the key ones that we see clients leveraging to sort of prove their value and make sure that the stories they're telling are actually landing.
Final question for you, and it's a bit left field, but I want you to think towards the end of your career, whether that's in marketing or elsewhere, what do you want to be remembered for?
Yeah, I mean, for me personally, I derive so much joy from teaching and seeing other people grab onto something and able to go and do it. I think what lights me up is taking something that I've grown confidence in and seeing that start to grow confidence in other. And so I think, as like cheesy as it sounds, I want to be remembered as somebody who was willing to help. I think there's a lot of people who are closed off about what they're doing. I think there's lots of people who loudly bang the drum about what they're doing, but it's only to like aggrandize themselves. And I hope that I'm remembered as someone who was genuinely interested in helping others do things well and do things better, and someone who, you know, like I'll often say, I don't always respond quickly, but I do always respond. And I hope that that's, you know, the attitude that I'm remembered for, is a willingness to try to help and an openness about, you know, here's how to come at that problem you're facing. Because I think there's more than enough business for all of us. I think we all start somewhere. And I think as I, you know, mature in my career, I'm starting to get better at asking for help myself. And I really value the people who are willing to give it. So, yeah, I think I'd put it that way.
A great answer, which is really encouraging to hear. So I'm going to drop a link to your website in the description of this episode and your LinkedIn profile. Is there anything else that you want me to connect it up to?
We recently launched a twice monthly newsletter that has a lot of just practical ideas, tips, examples. You know, we've got a really great blog on the site where, again, you'll find lots of prescriptive, practical stuff you can go to on your own. And the newsletter is just one more way of, you know, staying current on all of this. If case studies fall to you, or you have a team that you're trying to enable, I think that's probably worth checking.
And that's it for this episode of B2B Better. Thank you so much for giving me your time this week. If you are a repeat listener, thanks for coming back. If you did take any value out of this interview, please make sure you subscribe, rate, and review in your podcast platform of choice. It really makes a huge difference for an emerging creator like myself. Ugh, that sounded so bad, emerging creator. But I'm going to stick with it because we're here. If you want to learn more about the services at B2B Better, you can visit my website, www.b2b-better.com. A huge thanks to my guest this week. See you all next week.